From Ground Zero Radio, this is Democracy Now in Exile. Washington says it can't find Osama bin Laden, but it's communicating with him. The U.S. will attend the WTO meeting in Qatar after receiving assurances from bin Laden that it's safe. We'll talk with the reporter who broke the story. What is national security? War, more police, detentions and surveillance, or global economic justice? Anti-globalization activists reframe the debate. And should activists organize against the war? Discussion between Todd Gitlin, Katha Pollitt, and young anti-war activists. All that and more coming up. Welcome to the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The U.S. has used the biggest conventional bomb in its armory, the 15,000-pound Daisy bomb, the 15,000-pound Daisy cutter, at least twice in Afghanistan in the last few days. The bombs are pushed out of the back of C-130 aircraft on pallets and detonate about 3 feet above the ground, covering a mile-wide area with a mushroom cloud of aluminum powder which burns at about 10,000 degrees Fahrenheit. The explosion has been described as being like a nuclear weapon without the fallout. The Pentagon says it's using the bombs on Taliban caves. The blast would crush underground tunnels and structures, and people inside would be incinerated. The Washington Post is reporting the initial global outburst of solidarity with the U.S. after September 11th has frayed considerably. In opinion polls and interviews in several countries in Africa, Asia, South America, and Europe, many people who say they're horrified by the September 11th attacks added that the horror then does not justify the bombing of Afghanistan now, even if their governments continue to back the U.S. campaign. Many say it's not so simple as what Bush describes as a battle between good and evil. In Germany, polls show more than 65% of respondents now want the U.S. attacks to end. In Spain, a poll shows nearly 70% want the bombing to stop. Support for the U.S. war has also dropped dramatically in France and Britain. Meanwhile, President Bush yesterday delivered what The Guardian is calling his most belligerent speech since the wavering U.S. bombing campaign began, issuing two extraordinary messages to his allies as he tried to keep them in line. He first described what could happen if Osama bin Laden obtained nuclear weapons. Then he threatened his allies with action if they failed to provide more support to the U.S. He says, "A coalition builder must do more than just express sympathy. A coalition builder must perform." The president went on to say, "It's going to be important for nations to know they will be held accountable for inactivity. You're either with us or you're against us in the fight against terror." The London Guardian is reporting that FBI and military intelligence officials in Washington say they were prevented for political reasons from carrying out full investigations into members of the bin Laden family in the U.S. before the terrorist attacks of September 11th. FBI documents shown on BBC News last night and obtained by The Guardian show they had earlier sought to investigate two of Osama bin Laden's relatives in Washington and a Muslim organization, the World Assembly of Muslim Youth, with which they were linked. But the FBI files were closed in 1996, apparently before any conclusions could be reached on either the bin Laden brothers or the organization itself. High-placed intelligence sources in Washington told The Guardian this week there were always constraints on investigating the Saudis. They said the restrictions became worse after the Bush administration took over this year. The intelligence agencies had been told to back off from investigations involving other members of the bin Laden family, the Saudi royals, and possible Saudi links to the acquisition of nuclear weapons by Pakistan. Meanwhile, the FBI has conducted what the intelligence that the FBI has concluded that the intelligence behind last week's warning that terrorists might attack West Coast bridges wasn't credible. The FBI had received uncorroborated intelligence suggesting terrorists might strike suspension bridges on the West Coast and issued a private warning to law enforcement in 8 states. The warning also went to many companies in the region through the FBI's InfraGuard network that alerts industry to threats. California Governor Gray Davis then took the information public the next day, and a top FBI official acknowledged agents still had few clues in the investigation into anthrax attacks, and that federal law enforcement officials still didn't know the number of U.S. labs that handled anthrax or other biological agents. Republican multi-billionaire media mogul Michael Bloomberg parlayed his bankroll and Mayor Rudy Giuliani's backing to narrowly defeat Democrat Mark Green last night to become New York's 108th mayor. In a 5-to-1 Democrat town, Bloomberg spent more than $50 million of his own fortune, spending more money in a city mayoral race than ever before in the country. Green faced lingering resentment among Latinos and blacks who were upset by what they considered racially divisive tactics against the Bronx Borough President Fernando Ferrer in the Democratic primary runoff. Ferrer, Bronx Democratic boss Roberto Ramirez, and the Reverend Al Sharpton refused to speak out for the consumer advocate Mark Green this past week, likely costing Green crucial votes in minority neighborhoods that are Democratic strongholds. In New Jersey, Democrat Jim McGreevy was elected governor, ending 8 years of Republican control. In Virginia, Democrat Mark Warner, a multimillionaire cell phone mogul, defeated Republican Mark Early to become governor. And Cincinnati Mayor Charlie Lukin won re-election despite harsh criticism of his response to mass protests sparked by the police killing of an unarmed black man last spring. Organizers of the annual World Economic Forum will announce today they're preparing to abandon Davos, its alpine home for the past three decades, in favor of New York. The decision comes after a disagreement with the Swiss government over security and who should cover the cost.
Marching on the Freedom Highway. Marching each and every day. Marching on the Freedom Highway. Marching each and every day. I made up my mind, and I won't turn around. I made up my mind. Some folks think freedom march is not designed for all men. Marching. There are so many people march living their lives perplexed. Marching. Wondering in their minds march what's gonna happen next. Marching.
The War and Peace Report. I am Amy Goodman, and that was Freedom Highway. Not exactly what we see outside of the firehouse here in downtown Manhattan. Just this morning, as I came in on a taxi cab, the police block checkpoint outside, we were stopped by the U.S. Army. They asked the taxi cab driver for his documents. They were fully armed. The U.S. soldiers who came over in their camouflage uniforms. And when they left, I asked the cab driver how he felt. He said, I am a Muslim, and this is what it is to be a Muslim in America today. Well, the Bush administration and Pentagon may not be able to find Osama bin Laden, but they're communicating with him through the Emir of Qatar, at least according to the German newspaper Die Tageszeitung. This week, trade ministers from around the world are traveling to the tiny Gulf Emirate of Qatar, where the WTO will begin its ministerial meeting on Friday amidst unprecedented security. After massive popular protests disrupted the last WTO meeting in Seattle, Qatar was the only country willing to host this year's gathering. The country has no freedom of speech or assembly, no political parties, unions, or elected legislature, and had pledged to tightly restrict the entry of WTO critics to prevent protests. Qatar is home, however, to the cable network Al Jazeera, the freest source of news in the Arab world. Since September 11th, U.S. officials have slammed Al Jazeera for carrying criticism of the U.S. and broadcasting tapes of Osama bin Laden. The attacks on the World Trade Center and Pentagon decisively changed the significance of the WTO meeting. Many countries, including the U.S., worried about the possibility of political unrest and event terrorist attacks in Qatar, while the U.S. and Britain bombed Afghanistan. But the WTO decided to go ahead with the meeting after the U.S. received assurances, apparently from Osama bin Laden, that there would be no trouble. We're joined by Andreas Zumach, who is the reporter who broke the story. He joins us from Geneva. Welcome to the War and Peace Report.
Good morning, Amy.
Well, tell us what you understand the line of communication is.
Well, let's start with the history before September 11th. Qatar was the only country, after the events of Seattle in December 99, the only country among the 142 WTO members which was prepared to organize this fourth WTO ministerial conference. Everybody was happy about that because, as you pointed out, Qatar would ensure that critical non-governmental representatives would not get into the country, that there would be no demonstrations. And I would warn against mixing the kind of critical demonstrations we have seen in Seattle and at other places over the past years with what we now call terrorist attacks. I think these are two different things. After September 11th, though, the U.S. security agencies, CIA, NSA, and others, provided the Bush administration with a huge amount of very detailed threat assessments concerning Qatar itself and the neighboring countries of Oman, the United Arab Emirates, Saudi Arabia, so the Gulf region. There were threat assessments, for instance, that the Qatari security forces, the army, the police, were, quote, not capable of doing the job of protecting such a meeting like the WTO ministerial conference, that they were not politically reliable, that, for instance, the army is comprised to up to 90% out of citizens of Yemen and not of Qatar, that the army is infiltrated by al-Qaeda cells, that a number of al-Qaeda cells are operating in the country, and that the venue where the WTO meeting is supposed to be held, the big Sheraton hotel complex, which is shaped like a big pyramid, would be, quote, a prime target for air attacks like the ones that happened on September 11th in New York at the World Trade Center. So this was a security assessment the Bush administration got right after 11th of September from its own security agencies. And on the basis of that, the U.S. Trade Representative Robert Zoellick was very concerned, and he tried everything to find an alternative venue to Doha. There were contacts with Geneva, which is the headquarters of the WTO, but the Swiss authorities immediately rejected this idea because they are afraid of Seattle-like demonstrations. Singapore would have been prepared, even though it would have been difficult to organize it within 4 or 5 weeks. After the military strikes against Afghanistan began on October 7th, the assessment somewhat changed within the Bush administration. And in the end, those like President Bush, Vice President Cheney, Secretary of Defense Rumsfeld prevailed with their view that taking away the conference from Doha would be perceived not only in Qatar but all over the Arab world and the Islamic world as an insult, and this might endanger the support for the international coalition against terrorism. And the final decision for the U.S. government to go to Doha came in a telephone call on October 18th between Vice President Dick Cheney and the Emir of Qatar, Emir Khalafi Al-Thani. In this talk, the Emir told Cheney that, number one, they had the al-Qaeda sympathizers in the country full under control around the clock, and he secondly told them, and this is a new thing now, that he, the Emir, got assurances from Osama bin Laden and the al-Qaeda network that they would not conduct any attacks before and during the WTO conference. And the Emir had gotten this assurance by threatening to close down the Al Jazeera television station, which, as you said earlier already, is so far the only channel through which bin Laden and the al-Qaeda people could get their positions and messages out to the world. So, but the U.S., by deciding to go ahead with having the conference in Doha and to send a delegation with three members of the government, at the same time could not be sure and was not sure that they could 100% rely on those assurances. And therefore, after October 18th, there have been a number of rather secretive briefings in which all those U.S. citizens who originally had planned to go to Doha, who already had booked hotels, bought tickets, etc., have been briefed intensively and very detailed about the security assessments of the CIA and others. I'm talking about the government delegation members, I'm talking about U.S. senators, members of Congress, I'm talking about business representatives and lobby groups who plan to go to Doha, and also the non-governmental, the more critical non-governmental NGOs. At none of these meetings, as far as I'm informed, the government clearly told people not to go. But the net result is that after having been briefed about the security risks and about the very stringent security measures that are being taken, especially to protect U.S. citizens down there, 75% of all U.S. citizens who originally had planned to go to Doha will not go.
We're talking to Andreas Zumach, who is with the German newspaper Die Tageszeitung, which broke the newspaper, broke the story. USA received assurances from bin Laden for a WTO conference in Doha, the capital of Qatar. How do you know this?
Well, I got my sources are diplomatic sources, diplomatic circles of the US, of Qatar, of Pakistan, and sources in the WTO headquarters here in Geneva. Pakistan is of importance because prior to the telephone conversation between Vice President Cheney and Emir Al-Thani on October 18th, these same kind of assurances from bin Laden had been already channeled to the CIA, and this happened via the Pakistani security service.
And how exactly is bin Laden communicating?
Well, bin Laden is communicating through messengers with the Qatari government, as far as I was informed. I have no indications that he himself personally, I mean physically, has been in Doha in this period since September 11th, though it cannot be excluded. But I simply don't have this information. You know there are persistent informations which have been published by the French newspaper Figaro last week and the Radio International in Paris, that bin Laden actually spent 2 weeks in a special hospital in Dubai, the capital of the United Arab Emirates, in July this year, and that he was visited during these 2 weeks by a high-ranking CIA agent. For this, there are at least six witnesses. The story is being denied by the CIA. But according to these French publications, and they stick to their story, bin Laden has been in July for 2 weeks in the United Arab Emirates, which is a neighbor country to Qatar. So it might well be possible that he also has been in Qatar. But again, I don't know that, according to my information, this assurances have been passed on to the Emir through messengers of the Al-Qaeda network.
Meanwhile, a front page story today, Washington Post, that worldwide support for the war is falling. You're in Geneva. You write for a German newspaper. What is the sentiment in both places?
Well, in Geneva, there is still a, let's say, aftershock about the fact that the two important bodies of the United Nations in New York, this is the Security Council and also the General Assembly, both on September 11th, again September 28th, and on October 8th, after the military strikes against Afghanistan began, gave what since is being interpreted a green light for these kind of military strikes. There has never been an explicit formal mandate given to for these military strikes, but the very fact that the Security Council twice and the General Assembly once took unanimous decisions, and in the case of the meeting after the military strikes began on October 7th, did not reject the arguments the American and the British ambassadors put forward. All this is being interpreted as de facto a political consensus and agreement to the strikes. Secretary General Kofi Annan was here last week, And he was asked very tough questions here, which he could not answer very well. He was, for instance, asked whether in the future, if any country feels threatened and feels the right to use Article 51 of the UN Charter, which is the collective or individual self-defense right, whether this country then could go ahead with military attacks even without getting an explicit mandate by the UN Security Council. And he only could say that, to his interpretation, these recent decisions in New York only refer to the case of Afghanistan. He then was asked whether he is, what his perception is of what the military goals and what the military strategy of the U.S. in this war in Afghanistan is. And he had to drop his pants and only could say that he is not privy to these information, that he is not being briefed about the strategic and tactical goals of this war, and that therefore he couldn't answer this question. But at the same time, the war is being perceived as being supported by the UN, and the humanitarian organizations of the United Nations system, who all are based here in Geneva, like the Refugee Organization, the World Food Program, they are very much upset about this, and for them it's probably the biggest challenge since the end of the Second World War. In my own country, Germany, as the listeners probably know, the government of Chancellor Schröder and Foreign Minister Fischer, Schröder being a Social Democrat, Fischer being a Green member, for weeks have now urged the U.S. government to ask them to make some kind of military contribution, not only to give the political support, as Germany did right away after September 11th, for any kind of military actions, but also to actively participate. And finally, yesterday, the German government announced that they would send 3,900 soldiers into the war, both army forces, sea-based forces, special tanks against nuclear, chemical, and biological weapons. The German government is claiming that there was a specific request coming from Washington. Secretary of Defense Rumsfeld last night has denied that. So this is still an open question which is under debate in Germany. It looks, though, as if the coalition government of the Greens and the Social Democrats don't get their own majority together once Parliament will debate and decide about it, first time probably tomorrow, Thursday, and because a number of members of the Green Party of Parliament will vote against it, and even among the Social Democratic majority group in the government, there is some resistance. So Schröder will only get the support by the parliament if the Christian Democrats and liberal opposition vote in favor, which they most likely will do. The only party that is against it is the Party of Democratic Socialism, which is the successor of the former East German Communist Party. There will be a number of rather big demonstrations and rallies starting tonight in Germany and also over the weekend and next week. Here in Geneva, it's expected that over the weekend, starting Saturday, there will be big demonstrations against the WTO round to be held in Doha and against the idea of having a new comprehensive round of trade negotiations.
Andre Zumach, thanks very much for that comprehensive look at both the WTO and the story that you broke in your newspaper, Die Tageszeitung, about the U.S. receiving assurances from bin Laden for the World Trade Organization to go on smoothly in Qatar. Stay with us. The group Fizz singing at a peace rally in Charlottesville. on October 28th here. You are listening to the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. As the U.S.-led war on Afghanistan continues, global trade is increasingly being invoked as a new weapon system. The U.S. Trade Representative Robert Zoellick dubs the new agenda fighting terrorism through trade. In the wake of the terrorist attack on the United States, the U.S. and Europe have intensified efforts to launch a new round of global trade negotiations at the WTO meetings that's scheduled in Qatar. Canadian, U.S., European, and South American groups have called November 9th, the first day of the WTO meetings, as an international day of protest against the WTO. We're joined right now by Tony Clark, who is co-chair of the Common Front in the World Trade Organization and vice chair of the Council of Canadians. Tony Clark has just recently written a paper which points out that the war against terrorism is being fought primarily on the issue of physical safety, not the deeper dimensions of common security. Can you talk about how you're reframing the issue of national security, the whole question of what actually guarantees security?
Well, I think there's no doubt about it that you know, everybody was faced with a major blow as a result of what happened on 9/11, and so therefore there had to be a complete rethink of the way in which we go about these issues. And we all know that months before September 11th, there was a huge demonstration in Genoa, which I think was probably the apex of the anti-corporate globalization movement. But as in the wake of 9/11, we are all faced with having to rethink the way in which we approach these issues, simply because the number one concern that's on people's minds is security. The problem is that security is defined in terms of physical safety, as your introduction indicated. And really, security has to do with a whole lot of other things, whether or not people feel secure in their jobs, whether they feel secure in terms of their incomes, whether they feel that health and education and water are secure parts of their common life, and whether or not people have secure access to food and so forth. And so these are fundamental issues and dimensions of security, and have been for a long time fundamental to the definition of what security is in the broadest sense of the term. So what many of us have been trying to do is to say, well, look, we need to recast the way in which we come at these issues, still sticking with the same theme, still sticking with the same analysis about corporate-led globalization, but do so in a way that starts to talk about these issues again in the context of what's uppermost in people's minds.
So can you talk about how you're reframing this in terms of security and the specific areas that you think are most important?
Well, principally what we had to do in our work is that we had built a campaign through the summer leading up into the fall, and then when September 11th came along, we had to completely reframe that campaign. And the way in which we did it was that this was a campaign leading up to the ministerial meetings of the World Trade Organization, which start at the end of this coming week. And therefore, we needed to kind of reframe our campaign in terms of the World Trade Organization and its impact. So therefore, we began to take a whole new look at the World Trade Organization and our analysis of it. And we began to see that if there is a cause or a set of causes about global insecurities, it has to do with the way in which this institution has been put together and the way it operates. So let's kind of go back at things again and take a look at that from that perspective. And we began to see that the World Trade Organization really has rules that are built into it that really do not promote job creation, that do not promote income distribution, and therefore causes economic insecurity. We saw that the power that's concentrated in the WTO gives the enormous power to a body of trade experts to strike down laws, policies, and programs of democratically elected governments. That creates political insecurity. We saw, for example, that the GATS negotiations that are taking place at the WTO right now on are now getting into setting a set of rules for a whole area of social services and public services that cover healthcare and education and water and environment services. And this is going to create enormous insecurity in those areas. And the same in the agricultural negotiations on food. I mean, the whole emphasis is on enhancing the power of agribusiness corporations over that of small producers and small farmers, and so therefore creates another set of food insecurity for a lot of people in the world. So we began to redefine things along those kinds of lines and began to see those issues in those terms, and particularly looking at the impact of what the WTO does as a real engine of global insecurity.
We're talking to Tony Clark. He's co-chair of Canada's largest public interest organization. It is called the Council of Canadians. We're speaking to him in Ottawa, where next week there will be a meeting of the G20. What is the G20?
Yes, that'll be on November 17th to 19th. It's the G20 is made up of the finance ministers from a number of the leading industrialized countries and a few select countries from the south. And they will be meeting in Ottawa. This meeting is really an attempt to try to bring together the agenda that was supposed to be a part of the World Bank and IMF meetings that you will recall were to be held in Washington, D.C. at the end of September, but were canceled in the wake of what happened on 9/11. And so, therefore, that agenda, in effect, is now going to be transferred to these Ottawa meetings starting November 17th to 19th.
What about the crackdown that we're seeing in the United States and the whole discussion of dissent? How much space is there for that? Do you see people who are traditionally out in the streets and very outspoken afraid to turn out?
Definitely that same kind of atmosphere, perhaps to a slightly lesser extent, exists here in Canada at the present time. In the sense that we are going through, just like you are, the homeland security apparatus is being put together there in the United States. We are faced with a new set of legislation, what we call an omnibus bill, which is going to call for major changes in a whole variety of pieces of legislation in this country, dealing with our immigration policies, our refugee policies, the powers that the police have for search and seizure, and all of this, of course, will be put together in a way that will mean that there is a whole new set of restrictions going to be put on civil liberties. We just had, just to give you an example of this in terms of our own sensitivities, is that for the lead up to the WTO at the end of this week, the big meetings that are going to be taking place in Qatar. We have had a caravan going from the western part of the country and a caravan going from the eastern part of the country. And that caravan's been going to communities and towns across the country, meeting with people and talking about the World Trade Organization, and much in the same way that I've just been talking a few minutes ago. And on that caravan, we have people from different countries in the south, from Bolivia, from Colombia, from India, from parts of the Caribbean, and the people from Colombia, for example, the person is in real danger herself in terms of her own life back home, and so we've had to be very extra careful with regards to that caravan and how that caravan proceeds from town to town and city to city. We know that the police and the security forces are watching very closely. And therefore, we have to be very extra cautious and extra careful.
Tony Clark, I want to thank you very much for being with us, co-chair of the Common Front on the World Trade Organization, vice chair of the Council of Canadians, the largest public interest group in Canada. You are listening to the War and Peace Report as we come back home to the United States to have a discussion, perhaps a debate, about the war and where progressives in this country stand today. There's a front page piece in the Washington Post today that says, "War support falls worldwide. September 11th doesn't justify bombing," many say. And it starts off in Mexico City. says it was a traditional altar for Mexico's Day of the Dead observance, filled with flowers, candles, and sweetbread laid out for departed loved ones. Except this one also featured bagels and photos of New York, and it sat next to the U.S. Embassy as a show of solidarity with the victims of the September 11th attacks. Mexicans who showed up to inaugurate the display made clear their sympathy for the dead in the United States, but they also made clear that sympathy did not necessarily translate into support for the U.S. war in Afghanistan. Well, today we're going to talk about people mobilizing against that war and the different strategies they've taken. We're joined by Todd Gitlin, professor of culture, journalism, and sociology at New York University, author of The 60s, The Twilight of Common Dreams. Katha Pollitt is with us. She is a columnist with The Nation magazine and author of the book Subject to Debate, Sense and Dissents on Women, Politics, and Culture. We're also joined by Kristen Scher, who is a social justice activist working with the New York Anti-War Coalition. She's a political science graduate student at the New School here in New York, and Eric Tang, an organizer with the Committee Against Anti-Asian Violence. Todd Gitlin, you wrote a piece that appeared on Common Dreams, liberal activists finding themselves caught between a flag and a hard place. Explain.
There's a tendency on the part of people faced with an unprecedented situation to find precedents for it and to repeat themselves. Generals are famous for fighting the last war, and I think anti-war activists are at risk of fighting against Vietnam. This isn't Vietnam. And the arguments that are made are as, and the tone in which they're made are as important, I would say actually more important than the positions, because the dilemma is a real one. It's not a spurious dilemma. When a large number of people who are citizens of a country are killed, the government is expected to protect them. And the question is how to do it, not whether to do it. Now, there are many important questions to be raised against the war that's on, and I share in the dismay about that war. But I think it's also the obligation of people who are opposed to this war to give a real, not a rhetorical, not a casual, but a substantial answer to the question, what should the U.S. government do to protect American citizens? This is not a casual answer. You can't say, as we said in the 60s, and as it was right to say in the 60s, when asked, how can we withdraw our troops from Vietnam, put them on boats. That was a legitimate and sufficient answer. It's not a sufficient answer in this case. Bin Laden is not the invention of George Bush. He was not manufactured by the CIA. He's an actual person with an actual organization of people who are trying to put together the maximum possible murderous power against Americans. This can't be simply foisted off upon a non-existent court to be captured by non-existent police. Are we supposed to be dropping subpoenas on parachutes? I mean, that's as laughable as dropping peanut butter and bean sandwiches in Afghanistan. So I think the problem for the anti-war movement is how does it retain or get credibility? Most people are not pacifists. Hardly anybody is a pacifist. If you're a pacifist, then you have a consistent position. But if you're not a pacifist and you think that in principle the use of force can be legitimate, then what do you propose to do? I think that's a fair question to be posed to anti-war activists.
And Katha Pollitt.
Well, Todd and I were just saying that we agreed with half of each other's columns. And I agree with a lot of what Todd said. I guess I certainly don't have any, brilliant foreign policy solutions for what we should do at this point. But I do think it is relevant how we got to this place. And it is relevant what the consequences, intended and unintended, of what we're doing now, the bombing of Afghanistan, are going to be. I mean, I think this Washington Post article is not the only one that says people around the globe do not support this. The outcome could be, the long-term consequences could be very bad. I think that's important to think about. I would be so much happier is not the word, but I would feel less anxious about what our government is doing now if the UN had a role, for example. But how could the UN have a role that wouldn't look just like the United States steamrolling over it, given that we walked out of the Durban Racism Conference. When the International Court makes a decision we don't like, we just say, well, too bad. I think there is a history here that has brought us to this place. And you can't, the world didn't begin on September 11th. And I think it's very important for the peace movement or the anti-war movement to raise those questions.
Eric Tang, you are an anti-war activist. What is your response to you can't just do nothing?
Well, I want to begin by maybe addressing the issue around the anti-war movement, or the core of the anti-war movement, what that is, what that looks like. I think it's clear to say from the outset that the anti-war movement today, the nascent anti-war movement, and the anti-war movement, from what I understand, of 30 years ago, during the Vietnam conflict, was diverse. And today we see that same diversity. We see many different trends. And I wouldn't say that there's a central axis in this anti-war movement. So I want to begin by saying, when we talk about the current war, anti-war movement being filtered through the prism of a Vietnam anti-war paradigm, I want to really question, well, what and who? Primarily, I'm thinking of the new immigrant communities, the new racial communities here in New York City, who after 9/11 carried out some very creative and interesting anti-war activities that didn't really hit anyone's frequency, but were powerful nonetheless. I'm thinking of undocumented Mexican worker communities that came out calling for peace 2 or 3 days after they found out that hundreds of their community members had been lost at the World Trade Center. I'm talking about communities that worked in the Arab and South Asian and multinational Arab communities who courageously stepped forward to talk about peace in the days following 9/11 when they were physically at risk. I think there's a new anti-war movement among these communities that we have to pay careful attention to that really don't have much to do with this prism that we're calling the Vietnam War anti-war movement.
Todd Gitlin.
Well, I think it's extraordinary that Mexican immigrants and South Asians and others at risk carved out a space to take that position. On the other hand, to call for peace, it seems to me, won't do. Because there's a real problem. And it's a real problem for Mexican immigrant workers and South Asians and people of every origin. I don't think you have to be a Yahoo who supports the demented crusade that Bush blurted out to understand that there is in the world a real force that wants to create a super state. And it's a super state along the lines of the Taliban. And it's a super state that is potentially fueled, it's true, and worryingly true, by the bombing that's going on today. But it is nonetheless a super state that intends a rollback of the best of Western values against the reason of Islam, against the reason of Christianity, against the reason of atheism and the Enlightenment, against the reason of Judaism. It is a menace to real life. And we're not there yet. We're not, that is, Bin Laden doesn't have the apparatus, but he would surely like to get it. And this can't be blown away as a fiction of American imperialism. It has to be taken on straight. And I don't see that the call for peace does that.
We're going to break for stations to identify themselves. We'll be back in this discussion about war and peace. Stay with us.
What is it good for? Absolutely. Nah. Listen to me.
Again. War. War.
War, Edwin Starr, here on the War and Peace Report as we break the sound barrier. This is Resistance Radio. I'm Amy Goodman. Our guest, Todd Gitlin, author of The 60s, The Twilight of Common Dreams, and coming out with his book, Media Unlimited, How the Torrent of Images and Sounds Overwhelms Our Lives, Katha Pollitt, Nation columnist and author of the book Subject to Debate, Eric Tang with the Committee Against Anti-Asian Violence, and we're going to go now to Kristen Schur, who is with the New York Anti-War Coalition, a student at the New School. Todd Gitlin says peace is not the answer right now.
What the peace movement in New York is trying to address at this point is that the United States does continually fund and put into place bloody regimes that do support its geopolitical interests, and then when the United States is finished with them, they toss them aside and take revenge on its citizenry, as we're seeing happening in Afghanistan right now, which we saw happen in Iraq, where a million people have died due to the sanctions. And even if we don't want to blame it all on the U.S. or, you know, think that it's all U.S. hegemony, we need to take those things seriously as well. And I agree with Katha Pollitt when she said the world did not start on September 11th. These things have been going on for years and years. In 1948, when Israel took over Palestinian territory and the U.S. continued to fund that, $3 billion a year. These are the things that are important for us to remember, that nothing started on September 11th. When the U.S. helped overthrow Mossadegh in 1953 and put the Shah in place, who then killed an entire generation of would-be radical students, leaving really only the only recourse for any sort of radical movement to be through religion. And here we see the spoils of that over and over and again. I also think that it's important for us to remember that we have seen no credible evidence that bin Laden had anything to do with this particular attack. Perhaps he did. I'm certainly not a fan of the man. The Taliban is a terrible, bloody regime. But we've been presented with nothing. So imagine if someone in Iran said, hand me over Reagan, I'm not going to give you any evidence, just hand him over, I'll do with him what I will. No one would do it. That's a laughable suggestion. And so we don't have much by way of international justice organizations. That's something that the anti-war movement is thinking about. What do we mean by justice right now? But bombing Afghan citizens certainly is not justice. And that's the most important thing to remember right now. And at the very least, we could have waited, seen actual evidence, presented it to the world, and let the UN take over, or let Afghanistan decide what they wanted to do about it, instead of just dropping bombs that look like food packages.
Katha Pollitt.
I want to just go back to what Todd was saying about this is a war of Enlightenment values versus the other kind of values, the bad fundamentalist medieval values. I guess I would quarrel with that. I think everything we've seen suggests that American foreign policy is one of the big issues here. I don't think that whoever blew up the World Trade Center did so because they want women to wear burqas. And I'm totally opposed to the Taliban and all of that. And I am a proud atheist myself. But I think that we have to take seriously the unfortunate fact that the issue of Israel and the Palestinians and the issue of the sanctions against Iraq are very important to millions of people around the world. And whether you want to say, well, that's because they're manipulated by their leaders, or that's because they're in so much despair or whatever, it has to be dealt with. And I think that it would be a really great move toward peace for the United States to really put some real pressure on the Israelis to be just to the Palestinians. And I think one of the only good things that has come out of this is that Bush was making little motions in the direction of a two-state, quote, solution, unquote.
Todd Gitlin.
Well, I'm certainly for the U.S. putting pressure on the Israelis to reach a just peace. And if I knew what to do about the U.S. support of the Shah of Iran,
50 years ago, I would gladly go to the barricades on that. But you see, we're now living in November 2001. The U.S. and the rest of the West was complicit in forcing a settlement upon the German Empire after World War I, which had dire effects. It stoked up inflation. Hitler was supported by Henry Ford and other Americans and many corporations, as we now well know. And the U.S. in that sense was deeply complicit. Nonetheless, then there was Hitler. And there he was with an army and a Gestapo and all the rest of that. And you could not replay that awful history. You just can't do it. Same thing is true now. The fact that many people in the world want the U.S. to change its foreign policy should be taken seriously. That doesn't mean that they know exactly what to do about American foreign policy, but it certainly is true that we should be doing that. And any claim, and I think the Democrats are deeply complicit here in thinking that in order to prove their patriotism, they have to collapse and terminate debate. There's no question, but that is awful. On the other hand, I disagree with Katha about one thing. I think that bin Laden did, and I can't see how it was anybody outside the realm of Al-Qaeda, since they had the means, they have tested their stuff, their people are implicated, their funds are implicated, there's evidence in the Tony Blair statement. This is not the sort of thing that holds up in court, but it was good enough to impress Musharraf, who after all had been supporting the Taliban for years. The U.S. has been trying, by the way, to get the Taliban to turn them over to justice for many years. The guy blew up the American embassies in Africa, showing very little interest in the victims of American foreign policy in Kenya and Tanzania. So I think that what's plain is that we have a real situation that is partly fueled by a hatred of American foreign policy, a list, by the way, that bin Laden shifts every few months as he finds a new way of gaining support. And of course, he's a politician, he does that. But of course they blew up the World Trade Center because they want women to wear burqas. They are an offshoot of Wahhabi Islam, which is a rollback program, a totalitarian program, which rides most heavily on the backs of women. And that is what he and the Taliban would do if permitted to get away with it.
Eric Tang.
I think Todd's question is a good question. I think it's a good challenge. The left needs to be stronger about talking concretely about what should be done. There's no question about that. But I think that there are other tasks that are just as pressing. And one of the main tasks we learned prior to September 11th, about 2 weeks before when we were in Durban, South Africa, at the World Conference Against Racism, and I think for many of us who were part of that delegation coming from the United States, we did feel a sense of endangerment even then. Why? Because the issue of Palestine was really the vanguard issue at that point. And NGOs from across the world, and we're not talking about just your radical wings, we're talking about your mainstream NGOs, were disgusted with the United States, both in terms of its failure to participate, its arrogance, and as well as its denial of some of the crimes that were happening in apartheid Palestine. They were also disgusted with the U.S. in terms of its treatment, its ongoing treatment of Iraq and the millions of children who have died. That has put us in a dangerous position internationally. We felt that before September 11th. Now, if you look at some of the discussion post September 11th, the main issues coming from the broader world community in terms of trying to, not to say that the activities of September 11th are all justified, but looking for an explanation, they do turn to these two major U.S. foreign policies, Palestine and Iraq. And we need, as left, to take care of that and begin to answer that and begin to shape our understanding of why the rest of the world, and not just the Islamic fundamentalist world, but students in Europe, students in Africa, South Africans who we marched with, are have no faith in the United States. And we need to begin to figure out how we craft an anti-militarism, a pro-justice, a pro-global justice agenda with those allies.
Christian Schur, how are you organizing in these last few minutes? The question has been raised, do people go out and protest in the streets?
Absolutely, we go out and protest in the streets. The day that the U.S. started bombing Afghanistan, 10,000 people mobilized and marched. We were stopped just short of Times Square, where I understand we must reach Times Square in order to get assurance of mainstream news coverage. So we didn't really get much coverage. We held a rally previous to that, asking for alternatives to a bombing campaign, asking to stop racist attacks against Muslims and Arabs in this country. We had 4,000 people, and the news showed two dozen kids waving flags on Staten Island and said, "It's all stars and stripes in New York today." There isn't a lot of honesty going on in the reporting right now. The CNN chairperson told his staff to make sure that they didn't spend too much time on the Afghan casualties, because right now it would be crass somehow to show suffering in Afghanistan. These are the things that we are organizing against.
Kathy Paula.
I just want to underscore something that that Kristen and Eric have been getting at, which is, you know, it may be that, okay, bringing up Mossadegh 50 years ago seems like you're bringing out, you know, the old history books from the closet, but Saudi Arabia is our ally right now, and Saudi Arabia is the home of the Wahhabism that that Todd is rightly so exercised about. And we've been all in favor of that. We supported the Pakistani government when it allowed all those horrible madrasas that promote this extreme, you know, misogynist and jihad-oriented form of Islam. So it's all happening now. It's not ancient history. And so I think that just as Todd is entitled to say, and I ask myself also, well, okay, so what do we do now? I think you have to say, well, what do we do now about the fact that we're still in bed with the very philosophy we claim that we are fighting against?
On that note, we have to wrap up the discussion. I want to thank everyone for being here. It's a continued discussion that we have all the time here on the War and Peace Report with these new faces and voices. Todd Gitlin, professor of culture, journalism, sociology at New York University. His coming book is Media Unlimited, How the Torrent of Images and Sounds Overwhelms Our Lives. We've also been joined by Katha Pollitt of The Nation, and her book is Subject to Debate, Sense and Dissents on Women, Politics, and Culture. Kristen Schur has been our guest from the New School, a New York anti-war activist, and Eric Tang, organizer with the Committee Against Anti-Asian Violence. That does it for the program. Democracy Now! in Exile is produced by Chris Abrams, Miranda Kennedy, and Brad Simpson. Our engineer and music maestro is Anthony Sloan. You can hear us at WBIX.org and webactive.com. We are broadcasting on Manhattan Neighborhood Network Channel 34 on CUNY Television late at night, on freespeech.org, and the Dish TV satellite channel 9415. We're broadcasting in exile from the embattled studios of WBAI, from the studios of The Band and The Fired, from the studios of our listeners. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening. Somebody please tell me what is